Well, happy birthday, Hubble Telescope, 25 years old. And we'll talk about some of the marvelous things that Hubble has brought us when we come back with Robert Zimmerman in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. For the next couple hours, we're going to talk about space. We're going to talk about the marvel of Hubble Telescope and some other great things going on. And you get to chime in next hour as well. We've got Robert Zimmerman back, of course. His website is BehindTheBlack.com. He's an award-winning space historian. And Robert, Hubble Telescope, never thought it would go 25 years, did you?
Nobody thought it would go 25 years. When they actually put together the budget and the original plans, George, they said, we're going to launch it and give it a five-year nominal mission. This is in 1990. And they generally work in five-year increments. When it hit 15 years, everyone said, whoopee-doo, this is spectacular. When they did their repair mission in 2009, the last shuttle mission to repair Hubble, on that mission, you know, they replaced some cameras, they fixed some cameras, they fixed other equipment, they refurbished the telescope. Incredibly, incredible mission repairs on several instruments that were just spectacular. They left that telescope with no instruments that had been launched with it in 1990. Every instrument that had been put on the telescope, the cameras, the spectrographs, every single one of them had been replaced over time.
In space.
In space.
That's amazing.
So it was state-of-the-art instrument in 2009, and at that time, George, they said, well, this is to give us five more years. Well, it's now 6 years, and they're hoping to get another 5 years, and we'll see how long it goes. When I wrote my book Universe in a Mirror, which is the history of Hubble and why it was built and who built it, I like to say that this is a telescope that would not die. That's the phrase I use all the time, because if you go down the history, just quickly summarizing it, in the 50s, when Lyman Spitzer first conceived it, nobody wanted to build it, including the astronomy community. They thought it was a bad idea. In the 60s, when he finally convinced the astronomers, he couldn't convince NASA to build it. When he convinced NASA to build it in the 70s, he couldn't convince, the astronomers couldn't convince Congress to fund it. When they finally convinced Congress to fund it in the 80s, they had construction problems and budget issues, and it looked like it wasn't going to get finished. When it was finished in the 90s, it got launched with an out-of-focus mirror, and you had congressmen and senators calling it a turkey, and they should shut it down. They fixed it in the 90s. And then in the aughts, when the Columbia accident happened and the administrative NASA wanted to cancel the final servicing mission to shuttle, no, that didn't happen either. They fixed it. And now, when they fixed it in 09, they added a docking port. Not a boat port you can climb through, but just simply so you can attach a spacecraft. Never had that before. It was always designed to work with the shuttle, with the robot arm. And the plan has been that when that orbit begins to decay, it's more than a decade in the future. It's in a very good orbit shuttle, so it's not the shuttle, the telescope. It's high enough up, and the atmosphere isn't very active because the sun hasn't been very active, so it's not decaying very fast. It's going to last at least a decade in that orbit. But when that orbit begins to decay, this object's big enough, it's going to hit the ground, and we have international treaties. We've got to bring it down under a controlled manner. So the plan is to send up a robot mission, ship to dock with shuttle, with the Hubble, with an engine that will allow it to be deorbited in the controlled manner. It'll burn up over the Pacific. And I'm betting you that when that time comes, we're not going to deorbit it. We will raise its orbit, and we will attach robot
That's
equipment.
Right. Save it again.
Save it again. That's my prediction.
We've got some great pictures, Robert, on our website of some of the Hubble pictures over the years. And I've got to tell you, my very favorite is still that deep space picture where they just shot into a dime-sized hole of darkness, and you saw thousands of galaxies there.
Well, actually, George, the speck for the first Hubble Deep Field was a blank spot in the sky near the Big Dipper, and it wasn't dime-sized. It was about the size of a speck of a grain of sand.
Even smaller? Oh, my God.
Yeah, seen from 6 feet away. So think about the size of a speck of sand, six feet away. That was about the size. And then they looked at it for about 3 weeks. It was basically a long exposure, you know. And it's blank. There's nothing supposed to be there. We've never seen anything there. But because of the long exposure, faint objects become visible. And in that first Hubble Deep Field, there were 3,000 galaxies, no stars.
And how many stars per galaxy? What do you think?
Oh, we're talking, I'll quote Carl Sagan, all right, billions and billions.
Of stars per galaxy.
Per galaxy. Now, that image had 3,000 galaxies, all in the early universe,
jeez,
far, far away. Later, ultra-deep field image was a slightly bigger image with a better camera. They saw 10,000 galaxies in a blank spot in the sky. Those are just two specks of sand. Just think about the whole universe there. It's awe-inspiring. And that was just Hubble. And that image gave us a glimpse, just a very glimpse, of the very, very early universe. And more importantly, it gives us a perspective of what Hubble is. Because it's an optical telescope, when it does an ultra-deep field image like that, a long, long exposure, it's essentially looking as far as the human eye can possibly see. Because if you get farther away, the redshift, the expansion of the universe, moves all light into the infrared. So at greater distances, optical, you wouldn't see anything more. And in fact, that's the case. Then when they did later ultra-deep fields of the same spot, additional objects did not reappear. You know, they did a deeper image. They didn't see more objects because at optical wavelengths, which Hubble is essentially works at, you don't see more objects. And so those images were essentially seen as far as the human eye could see. And that's, I think, just that takes my breath away every time I think about it.
It sure does.
We've seen the limits of our ability to see with our own eyes in the universe.
Robert, what's going on with the James Webb Space Telescope? Scheduled to launch, I believe, in 2018, isn't it?
Well, first, I want to make it very clear. NASA for many years has tried to sell James Webb as a replacement for Hubble, and it is not. We have to start from that right off the bat. It does not replace Hubble. James Webb is an infrared telescope. It's designed to look at deep space, look beyond, deeper than Hubble could in the infrared. But it will not look in optical wavelengths. It's not a general observatory in the same way Hubble was, like a regular ground-based telescope like the Hale Telescope in Palomar, where, you know, astronomers can compete for time and do almost any kind of research on it. James Webb is an infrared telescope designed, optimized to do cosmology, deep, deep, deep space stuff. And it'll do great stuff, but it is not going to replace Hubble. When Hubble goes, we won't have an optical telescope in space. Now, having said that, George, James Webb Telescope was proposed by astronomers in the early aughts, about 2002, and they said it would cost $1 billion to build, and they'd have it launched by about 2011. Its budget is now hovering close to $9 billion, and it's been delayed till 2018, and that is still questionable. There are issues with the infrared. Infrared is, you know, you're looking at heat, essentially. So they're going to put the telescope in a very cold spot, a million miles away, in the Earth's shadow. So it's very cold, and therefore any heat it gets will be the faint heat from far, far away. Obviously, you've got to be able to have a cryogenic system so that you can work in the infrared, and they've had trouble building the Webb's cryogenics. And that's still a question mark whether they're going to get that fixed on time. Webb is also not like Hubble. It is not going to be repairable. So if they have a problem like they had with Hubble upon launch, we won't be able to fix it, at least not in the near future. It's going to be a million miles from Earth. It has a grapple attachment so you can grab it, but we don't have the technology yet to get to that spot, either with robots or humans. And so if Webb doesn't work off the bat, Webb will be a $8 to $9 billion piece of junk.
What are we looking for in space, Robert? Why the missions? Why go to Mars? What are we looking for?
Well, let's talk about Hubble as an example. Before Hubble was launched, astronomers essentially were nearsighted and were not allowed to buy eyeglasses. You look through the atmosphere and you can't see sharply. And what astronomers thought they saw in space, it's very hard for people today to imagine what it was like as when I was growing up and you were growing up in the 50s and 60s and 70s before Hubble was launched. Our vision of the universe, galaxies, strange objects, planetary nebula, was fuzzy. We had really not a sharp vision of that. And so Hubble getting above the atmosphere allowed astronomers to put those glasses on, and we could see the universe sharply for the first time. And everybody through the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, when Hubble was being built, even those that were naysayers, it was hard to argue with launching Hubble, because as human beings, curious, this was an opportunity to finally get a sharp look at the universe in which we live, and no one could resist that. And that's one of the reasons Hubble wouldn't die, George, because every time someone tried to argue against it, the potential of seeing the universe sharply for the first time would win. There are stories of astronomers who originally opposed the telescope who became big, big time promoters of it in later years as they thought about the situation, because the possibilities were endless. And so you ask, why do we look? Well, because we're curious. We want to see what's there and try to understand the universe for where we live. And Hubble is, I think, a prime example of that. You know, my website, Behind the Black, where does the title come from, George? If you go to the website and you look at the banner, it's a picture of an Apollo astronaut with the rover on the moon, with the black and horizon and black sky behind them. And what Hubble has done, and our first this first generation, fifth half century of space exploration, has it's given us that first glimpse of what the universe really looks like. And what we're trying to see is what's behind the black of that black sky.
Are we looking for intelligent life?
We're looking for...
Is that the quest?
That's one quest. I mean, you can't limit it to one thing. Everything we're trying to understand the universe. Cosmology tries to understand how is the universe formed. That great why. You know, little kids ask why.
Yeah.
Why? And you go crazy.
It's the why. That's why we're doing this.
That's right. So we're trying to get an understanding of at least how it happened. You can't really, science is not really philosophy. It's not trying to understand why, but it is trying to understand how. And are we looking for intelligent life? Of course we are. But we're also looking for places we can colonize ourselves. We're trying to understand how to do that. We're looking for exoplanets where we could someday live on, even if there aren't alien civilizations. We're trying to understand how stars are born, evolve, and eventually die, because that will tell us how the universe formed. We are made of star material. You know, when supernovas happen, they give off a lot of material, dust. They manufacture the more complicated atoms in the universe, and that's what forms later planets and more complicated objects. So we are made of stars, and how do stars form? How did this whole universe take into shape? And we want to know that. So that's why we have Hubble. That's why we have
We may never get these answers, Robert.
What if we never get them?
Yeah, we may never get them.
You know, that's kind of like, George, that's kind of like saying, in 1580, we're never really going to have electricity. Well, you wouldn't even know it existed.
Well, but I mean, this question of why, who are we, what are we doing here, there may not be an answer to those questions.
Well, there might not, but that's philosophy. Yeah, you know, I'm not reluctant to discuss philosophy, but I always want to make it very clear that science is trying to understand how things are working, how they occurred, how the universe functions. How? It's a very important distinction. Philosophy tries to understand why, and we, religions, philosophers, the Greeks, the Romans, the Jewish religion, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, they're all attempting to understand the why and how, you know, why the universe is here, the ultimate reason it's here. And that's a very different quest than trying to understand how the universe formed. Many religions don't have a conflict between the search for how. Judaism has no problem at all with searching for how because it doesn't believe that there is a conflict there. God can create the universe any way it wants. Other religions have more of a problem with that. But, you know, that's part of our trying to figure out the why. But that's philosophy. It isn't science. And science, with Hubble as a good example, is those ultra-deep fields, for example, George. They give us a sense that about 10%, 20% after the universe formed in time, say approximately a billion to 2 billion years after the Big Bang, the data from those ultra-deep fields suggest there was a baby boom of star formation, that originally the stars formed more slowly, and then suddenly things coalesced in such a way that those galaxies could start to form stars much faster. And that's what they saw in those ultra-deep field images. And then over time, the rate of stellar formation has calmed down. Mm-hmm. And today, and in this time, it appears that stars don't form at the same rate.
But they're still forming.
But they're still forming. And so, all right, that gives us, from a perspective of humanity and understanding the universe, a slight glimpse into the long-term history of the universe, how it's developed over time, much like archaeology gives us a sense of past civilizations and when they existed, and studying history tells us something about how our civilization developed over time. Well, this is giving us a glimpse into the actual structural development of the universe. Now, I'm very careful to say it's a glimpse, because the universe is a very, very complicated thing, and our data at this point, it's once again, this is only the first generation, Hubble's the first telescope to ever take a sharp view of the universe above the atmosphere. And so our knowledge that we've got right now is really just scratching the surface. We're only just beginning to see the universe sharply, and we have to be aware of that in discussing this at all times. But we're getting that first glimpse, and we need to know that. Just like before Copernicus, they thought the Earth was the center of the universe. Better data, learning more about how the universe formed, better telescope, the arrival of the telescope, allowed humanity to then get a better understanding of the solar system itself and where we fit into it. And then later, astronomers looking at the sky began to realize that the universe isn't just filled evenly with random stars, but those stars are gathered into what they called cities, galaxies, and those galaxies are separate from each other. And that structure was not understood really 100 years ago, less than 100 years ago. It wasn't until Edwin Hubble himself figured out that the faint nebulae, many of the faint nebulae he was looking at, were not nebulae, they were not gas, but they were cities of stars, galaxies. And so we get a better understanding of the universe with time, and that, I think, is helpful for philosophers in the future to try to understand the why, having more information. You know, if you know that we're not sitting on the back of a turtle, you can, and instead we're part of a universe that was formed billions of years ago with many galaxies and stars, well, at least then you can start to build your philosophy of why based upon real understanding of the universe.
Do you think it's possible? Well, I'll ask you that after the break. My gosh, fast night. It's going by brutally fast. Robert Zimmerman with us, space historian. One of his books, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8. Hey, don't forget, you can always email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Bob Zimmerman with us as we talk about space. We'll take your calls next hour. Bob, can the universe stop growing in terms of no more stars, no more planets? It just all stops?
There are scientists who believe that entropy is essentially the motion, the development of the universe from organization to chaos. And basic equations say that entropy is unstoppable, that over time, the organized stars will burn out. It will be more difficult to form more stars. And as I mentioned earlier, that the formation of stars was much greater in the early universe. It's less now. And eventually things will run down. We might be talking trillions and trillions of years from now, a long time in the future. But there are scientists who say, as far as they can tell, with the data available, eventually the universe will run down and it'll expand out so that we can't even see other galaxies. We'll be so spread, the universe will have grown so large, expanded, so that no galaxy is within view of another. There's no additional new material, things will burn out, and yes, the universe will become a blackness with no stars and no life. That's based on what we know now. I think that our knowledge is somewhat limited at this point. I don't think we really understand the overall view. I think our knowledge of the universe is about equivalent to the prior to Copernicus and trying to understand the solar system with the Earth-centered system. We have limited amount of knowledge of what the overall universe is like. For many decades, mm-hmm. astronomers thought that there was a possibility that there was enough matter in the universe that would bring the universe, after it expands for a period of time, gravity would take over and pull it back together. It would have another big bang, and we'd have cycles. They actually have now found that it appears the universe is accelerating over vast distances, where it's expanding more over time on vast scales. The expansion rate of the universe is faster. It's kind of like if you blow something up, you expect the objects that fly away from the explosion to slow down as they get farther away because gravity pulls them back. Instead, they speed up. And we don't really understand this. We have no idea why that is. We don't even really understand what the reason for it is. In fact, the data for it has a lot of assumptions, and there's a lot of question marks about it, so we really don't have a handle on that. And so we don't really have a handle on the future of the universe either. Right now, based on what we know, yes, the universe is going to run down. Of course, if I bet money on it, I'll never win or lose, because I'll be long gone before they ever get an answer to that question. We don't really know at this point really what's going to happen down the road.
This is amazing. Now, the $64,000 question for you. Do you believe in intelligent extraterrestrial life?
Well, George, you've asked me that question before, and I'll say the same thing I said before. I have no idea. The typical response of most good scientists will be that the odds are in the favor of there being other intelligent life. And I would agree, the number of planets, as we've talked about earlier tonight, the number of stars in the universe, the number of galaxies in the universe, we're now finding that pretty much every star in our galaxy is likely has planets, exoplanets. So the numbers here are so gigantic that, yeah, it seems pretty likely that, yes, you should have other life forms, and many of them should be intelligent. There is one caveat to that, though. We have been listening with very sophisticated equipment in some manner now for almost a half a century for some signs of other intelligent life within our galaxy. If they had existed, just like we send out signals, we're not sending out signals to talk to someone, but our television broadcasts, this radio interview gets broadcast, and therefore it goes out into space. Well, after 60 years of listening, you'd think we've picked something up, and we haven't. So what does that mean? Well, we just don't know. I hate to be the constantly say we don't know, but I'm very aware of what our limits of our knowledge is right now. And so I haven't the faintest idea if there's other intelligent life out there. I would say that the odds are in favor of finding it, but right now we haven't. It's not there.
Now, here's a strange question, but what might be out there that we really haven't uncovered yet?
Let's talk about life for a minute.
Okay.
Even if there is life out there, it might be something so alien to us that we don't recognize it as life, nor do they recognize us as life. Think about that. I'm a big fan of Star Trek, and I find, after a while, Star Trek's vision of aliens to be very pedestrian and boring, because they're always a humanoid, and all they basically do is do a little bit of makeup around the head, and they're suddenly an alien. And they don't really behave significantly different than humans. But aliens are going to be aliens. Their sensory systems are going to be very different. Just like, look, just on Earth alone, you know, how an ant perceives the universe is completely different than how we perceive it. How do you communicate with dolphins? How do you communicate with them? It's a good example. Dolphins likely are intelligent, but their method of communication is very different from ours. It appears they use sound to paint. This is my speculation. They have a magnificent ability to produce complex sounds. Well, sonar is a way to produce images. Well, they're using sound like sonar to produce images between each other. But that's a completely alien way of talking compared to how we do it. And so they can't understand our language, and we can't understand theirs. And they're a species that's right here on Earth. So if there is life out there, it's very possible it's going to be extremely difficult to communicate with it. The areas of commonality are going to be very difficult to find. For example, if you have two human cultures that speak different languages, trying to find areas of common interest or communication can sometimes be quite difficult, because their culture is different, their approach to life is different, the way they do things is different, and their language is different. Well, that's just two human species. You try to communicate with an alien species that developed in an underground ocean on Europa, orbiting Jupiter, where they've never even seen the sun, and they have no reason to conceive of it, and it's in an ocean underwater that's dark, where the heat is generated by tidal forces from Jupiter. Well, at this point in time, even if they were there, we might not recognize them. So what don't we know? The area of uncertainty in knowledge in general is far greater. It's very important that scientists always carry a humbleness about them, because our knowledge, as much as it's improved for the last 1,000+ years, last 500 years since Francis Bacon and the scientific method was developed, Galileo, 500 years ago, the knowledge we've gained is spectacular, but the amount of ignorance we have and the vastness of the universe itself, the possibilities is unlimited. That's why I like science and the universe and study and planetary research, because there's always a surprise. We don't know a lot, and so we're always learning something new, and it's always a surprise. That's where. So you ask me, what don't we know? A lot more than we do.
Black holes. People are changing their minds whether they exist or not. What do you think?
Well, the scientists are pretty confident that black holes exist. What's interesting in the last decade and a half since Hubble was launched is that we now know that black holes come in a variety of sizes, and they are instrumental in the formation of galaxies, and that most galaxies, especially spiral galaxies, have gigantic supermassive black holes at their center. I mean, these are objects that are made up of masses billions of times our sun. So when you look at a galaxy, the whirlpool spiral galaxy, you're looking at a whirlpool. Think about a whirlpool in the ocean. It's being drawn down into the center. Well, in the center of a galaxy like that is a giant black hole with great gravity that's affecting the entire galaxy in its shape and structure. But scientists are pretty clear that the black holes exist. It's the details that we don't really understand much about. How they form, how do you get big ones like supermassive black holes in the center of galaxies. How is it possible they're finding now that the black hole in the center of our galaxy, which tends to be pretty quiet, it's still a very hostile environment for star formation, you'd think. But they're now beginning to find, astronomers, that baby stars can form right near a giant black hole like that. And that's counterintuitive. We would have never thought that such a thing is possible, but it appears to be the case. So it's more knowledge that's of mysterious nature of what's going on and how it's going on. We have to learn more.
Privatization of space. It's going to take over, do you think, government-funded programs?
Space exploration in the future is going to be privately done. And the United States is moving into that mode, I think, very successfully, thank God. Yeah, I've been pushing for this, George, for 20-plus years since I wrote Genesis, the story of Apollo 8. At that time, I predicted that the future of space exploration will be private enterprise. The government has resisted doing this, as well as our culture. We've been reluctant to give it a try. But in the last 6 years, we have made an effort to do that, finally, and we're making a transition from big government programs run by the government and planned and built and designed by the government, and instead with the government behaving more like a customer. It's buying the product from private companies, and the result of that is you're getting a lot of innovation. In the next 2 years, it's very possible the United States will have two different companies capable of putting humans in orbit, and it will have two different companies, capable of putting cargo capsules in orbit to bring cargo back and forth from space. That's four different companies essentially with the capability of bringing material up and down from space, humans and cargo. Each one of them is doing it a different way. Each one of them is actually doing it in such a way that almost all of them could be manned. Well, think about the flexibility it gives the United States.
Huge.
It's gigantic. And the thing about that that's really exciting is that they're competing against each other. So each one of them is going to try to top the other to do it better. And so even if this first generation of these multiple companies succeed, none of them are going to sit quiet with what they've done. They're going to try to find better ways to do it, to have it cost less and be more efficient and more science fiction-y in its design and innovation. And so we'll be getting into space easier and with greater frequency and for less cost. And once again, the cost goes down. And that means you can have more people can buy the product because it costs less. More people can buy the product. You have start to get economies of scale. The cost goes down even more. This is like computers. Same thing that happened with computers. The more people buy it, the more they can. You have economies of scale. You can start to build it cheaper. More people can afford it. You can build it cheaper. More people can afford it. Just continues forever, and soon you have a very robust spacefaring.
Will we still have our military program done by government?
Well, military is a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
Military, it's a completely different game. The federal constitution, American constitution, essentially gives the federal government really one task, really only one task.
To protect us.
And that's, to protect the country. And that was why they wrote that constitution back in the 1780s. The original constitution, the Articles of Confederation, didn't do the job. So defense is a government responsibility, and that will always be done by the government. But think about this. If you've got many different private companies going into space and innovating, coming up with that technology, it gives your government-run military a great deep resource to draw upon for accomplishing what they need to do. It is why we won World War II so effectively and why the United States dominated the world in the 20th century, because we didn't have a gigantic government. What we had was a very robust private citizenry and industry. Private industry, and when we needed to suddenly enter World War II, we went from almost no military to the most powerful ever created in less than 4 years. because we could, the military could draw upon that private citizenry and what it developed on their own. And that applies now into the future in space. If we have multiple companies that the government buys its products from to build spaceships and rockets and planetary probes, well, then that technology and skill set can be applied to almost anything else. And we see it. The space age reflects itself in miniaturization and in medical research and in computers and in phones and in, you know, iPads and everything you can imagine.
We haven't been back to the moon in 40 years in terms of mankind. Why not?
Well, I you know, it comes down to that same thing I'm just talking about. Since the 60s, we decided to copy the Soviet Union's way of doing things. So we went with a Soviet-style space program, and that was designed and run and controlled by the government, and when you don't, with no competition. And so when you have something like that, it gets bloated, not very efficient, very expensive, and doesn't accomplish much. And so we've been basically going around in circles for the last 45 years with no competition profit motive to create incentives.
Let me have you finish that up, Robert, when we come back, and then we'll take phone calls. Robert Zimmerman, our space historian.